Hi, I'm Natalie Argarius, and this is the Urbanist Podcast, where we discuss news, information, and ideas about improving cities and quality of life.
And I'm Ray DeBicke. In this week's episode, we're going to talk about the impacts that apps have on our cities and our city residents. Recognizing you're likely listening to this on an app, we're entering the metaverse. Stick around. So, Natalie, last week we were paying attention to some news reports out of New York where restaurants up there were flooded with orders from an app. Grubhub ran a promotion offering a free lunch, and at its peak, the app was posting about 6,000 orders a minute, and the restaurants in the city were completely overwhelmed.
I believe this is what inspired you to write your article that apps break cities just like freeways do.
It's been a weird thing to think about because it's so much of a flood that when apps start calling down a whole lot of people in different ways, it really effectively operates just like an exit ramp coming off of I-5.
Yeah, it's amazing to think of the magnitude of the impact. Something like a promotion from Grubhub could have on, you know, not only these restaurants, but also the circulation of traffic throughout different areas. There's just so many unintended impacts that can come out of it.
I had a hard time just starting to think through some of the things about these apps. And what really came to mind as I was working through understanding what was going on was that the icons themselves that appear on our phone for some of these apps are just a little picture. But when you hit a button in them, they really set gears into motion that involve thousands of people and millions of dollars moving through the economy. Just last week, there was an article by Cory Doctorow, and he was talking about the fat finger economy, where if you screw up and hit something weird on a YouTube app, all of a sudden millions of dollars of cascading revenue falls into the recommendation engine, even if you didn't want it to.
That reminds me of a technology that it may still exist, but it might have been discontinued, that was put out by, I believe, Amazon or maybe a competitor, where you could put a button in your house, and if you pressed it, it would order a replacement product for you. And it was marketed for things like detergent, laundry detergent, various food items, and people were having problems with their toddlers pressing the button repeatedly, and then massive orders showing up at their house.
Oh, if you need pizza sauce, you need pizza sauce, and you hit the button to get all the pizza sauce. And I only think of that because that is the only thing that I was thinking about getting that Amazon button for, was the one type of pizza sauce that we order from them.
Now, you know, when we think about things like this, it has to be like recognized that whenever we buy anything, there's a long supply chain and manufacturing chain that is occurring that we're not fully aware of, right? But it seems like the thing that happens with these apps is they make everything happen so easily that we're not thinking at all about the human beings who are participating in the chain of events. And the various other factors that, you know, bring these items or these services to our doorstep.
I have to say that in reading through and trying to understand a lot of exactly those streams that you're talking about, the comparison to mega projects in cities really did come to mind over and over again, because it is this shockwave that all sorts of apps cause moving through a city. That just like building a highway, they are bringing down an enormous amount of money through these venture capital fundings. And they really, when that lightning of enormous amount of money hits the ground, they really scrape things up. It's just like a bulldozer moving through a neighborhood. And it could just be a bulldozer moving through one restaurant because it became real popular on TikTok, or something like we saw in New York with a whole bunch of restaurants facing the same onslaught in an afternoon.
And it's kind of interesting because it can break down in two different ways. So on the one hand, it can disrupt established industries like the taxi industry, which Uber and Lyft and other rideshare platforms definitely did. But on the other hand, it can create a whole new demand for a service that didn't exist before. prior to things like DoorDash, some people had their groceries delivered to them, but not a lot. And now it's become something that, while I don't know that it's necessarily commonplace, it's certainly become much more common than it ever was in the past.
There was an old grocery store back in an old neighborhood that would deliver groceries, and it was a kid from high school who would just bring down a grocery bag for, you know, some of the older residents or people who have been going to the grocery store for a long while. But now that's a service that totally exists. Do you actually get groceries delivered?
I never have, actually. It has never even occurred to me to want to have them delivered to me. I mean, even during the pandemic, when I was really limiting how many runs to the grocery store I made, it's not something I can imagine wanting to hire another person to do for me. But maybe I've never been that busy or that important.
We get a farm box from a couple different places, and have also done the meal delivery apps where you get to make the food that they deliver in packages, and it worked really well for a couple weeks. And then I just started seeing the boxes pile up, and I was like, man, that's a ton more trash than I was ready to deal with.
That's true. So I will say that I have gotten produce from Imperfect Produce, mm-hmm. and you're totally right about the boxes. It feels, after a while, like so much packaging for a simple food order, especially because if you order certain types of fruit, they'll put ice packs in the box.
Right. And as long as we're not injuring ourselves readily, we don't need that many ice packs.
But, you know, going back to like that old fashioned model of delivery you were talking about, it's true. You know, we used to have the milkman. We used to have, you know, certain grocery stores would do their own kinds of deliveries. But those were people that had a regular job. They were just paid to perform the service.
And that's where really where a lot of these apps kind of feel extractive. It's almost like they're mining the community for hours, and they're throwing venture capital money at somebody who needs it in return for them spending the hours going out and doing some of these deliveries. And the equity in some of that really seems unfair.
Well, I'm so glad you mentioned the venture capital aspect of it, because I think it's really important. And it's one of the things that has made these apps destructive. Like, for instance, when Uber first hit the market, it was affordable in comparison to many traditional taxi companies. And in my conversations with drivers I had, most of them seemed pretty happy with the service. And many of them were actually people who had previously worked for taxi companies. And I can just share quickly that when I was a college student, my college boyfriend's father decided to get a job as a taxi driver. He was somebody who had struggled a lot and been very insecure in employment during his life and had limited work opportunities, and it was something that was available for him. But he had to purchase a taxi medallion in order to do it, and he actually ended up going into debt from which he never recovered, because in addition to purchasing that medallion, which is essentially like a licensure, he would have to lease the taxi from the company, and there were many days in which he actually didn't recoup enough to pay back the lease.
When we're starting to talk about the apps and moving forward with that, they really did represent a way to upset that medallion idea. And you could actually order them through your phone. I mean, how before Uber and before Lyft, you had to call into a cab company or find a cab stand.
And I remember in particular in Seattle, that cab service was difficult to access and often unreliable. I had actually a couple times in which I called cabs and I really needed them, like to get to a doctor's appointment or some other kind of basically emergency situation, and the cab driver never showed up. And all you could do was call the company, get put on hold, be promised another driver would come soon. I was just so pleased with Uber and with Lyft, with the fact that I could see where my driver was coming from when I had an estimated time of arrival, and I could see, okay, they're actually making their way over to me. Now, the problem, of course, is when that all fell through the floor, right? When, you know, the driver stopped making a living wage and the I can't say for certain that they were before, but they seem to be earning far less than they had early on. And then in addition to that, the rates began to increase.
So Slate had an article last week calling it the Uber subsidy, where it was venture capital was propping up those super duper low Uber rates. So yes, early on, drivers were getting a certain amount of money, and that started dwindling. And the Uber subsidy through this venture capital really represented a way for huge amounts of money to tear up the city, because we started planning transit around rideshare.
That's absolutely true. And it's amazing to think about that it wasn't something that just impacted the service economy like taxis. It actually began to have an impact on our built environment.
I mean, how many buildings now have a rideshare stand out front that never would have had a cab stand? And how much thinking have we done about transit recently, where we talk about people covering the last mile through an Uber or a Lyft?
Yeah, you're absolutely right that the impact of this has been really far-reaching.
The flip side of some of this is that we've always had huge international finance flows of money striking the earth and tearing up places in the city. Highways are one of them. The Olympics really does a number on the cities that host it. But over the course of years, I mean, it takes a decade to build an Olympic venue. Really, the amazing thing about some of these apps is how fast we can call down just this lightning strike of money onto a place, and we can see the recoil from the problems that money shows up.
I mean, I think the most important thing to remember with all of this is that it's fast changing and it's disruptive. And at times, you know, it's establishing it's disrupting these established industries. And at other times, it's creating new needs. Like I think of Airbnb, which I have it as an app on my phone. I also use it on, you know, just standard computer. But I mean, it's also, I think, kind of falling into that category where it's providing this new opportunity to stay in, you know, not a hotel, basically, when you travel, that has been really disruptive in a lot of ways.
Where, how much discussion about housing recently has included, oh my gosh, the neighbors turning into a bunch of Airbnbs?
I haven't written this article yet. I've been meaning to for a very long time, but my particular neighborhood is rife with Airbnbs. I have two Airbnbs that are located right behind where I live. And once I did a search and I found there were like 20 within like less than a 4-block radius, which was shocking.
It really can lend into the idea that people who don't own are necessarily transient and bad. But as a renter, I can say, no, we do okay. But when you have an Airbnb, and again, it is venture capital money turning over and disrupting the hotel industry, having a direct effect on stuff on the ground in a city. From a policy standpoint, Seattle is taking proactive steps to protect workers of app-based companies.
Seattle has been more proactive than some other cities in terms of trying to respond policy-wise to the challenges that are presented by these app-based companies. And the first real substantive step that Seattle took in this direction was to pass its Fair Share Ordinance back in 2020, which created a minimum level of compensation for rideshare drivers. That was also followed up this past legislative session by a law that was passed statewide in Washington that also provides some guarantee of minimum compensation, but only applying to the rideshare market. The city has been engaged for the last several months in creating a suite of legislation called Pay Up. And this has been done in partnership with both Working Washington, which represents the interests of app-based workers, and then also many of the large app-based companies such as DoorDash and Grubhub.
first of all, the name Pay Up is awesome. And it really focuses on turning towards these companies and saying, look, we have literally no idea what money is passing between you and your staff.
The lack of transparency can be really shocking. And they tried to conduct research on what people who were employed by these companies were actually earning, and found that consistently people were earning less than minimum wage. And so the initial goal with this legislation was to try to ensure that all workers in the city, including people who are app-based workers, can earn at least the current minimum wage, which right now in the city of Seattle is $17.27 per hour.
So the framework for the pay-up legislation starts with that $17.27?
That's correct.
And where does it go from there?
Yeah, so I'll just throw in right now as well who this actually applies to. So this applies, well, it was intended to apply to two categories of app-based workers: on-demand workers who do things like deliveries, and then marketplace workers who perform services. The marketplace workers were recently removed from the legislation by an amendment. I will get into that later. So when they were looking at how do we compensate people fairly for this work, it wasn't enough just to say, okay, we're going to say that, you know, this is going to all somehow equate per minute to the equivalent of, you know, earning $17.27 per hour. And that's because, you know, there are other costs that factor in. So they brought in a associated cost factor, which makes it so that the employees, because they're contractors, are receiving additional compensation to cover things like family medical leave, family medical leave costs, worker compensation costs, costs that would be typically paid for by an employer if somebody was considered to be a full employee of a business. There also is an associated time factor that was brought in. And that is meant to, take into consideration the fact that people need to have time to review offers. People need to have time to conduct administrative tasks like logs of their work at the end of the day. Altogether, the associated cost factor and time factor worked out to $23.40 per hour in the initial iteration of the policy.
So we start with the $17.27 minimum wage for the city of Seattle. We add in cost factors and we add in time factors, and that comes out to an extra $6 or so to $23.40.
That's correct. And then there's one more cost that was factored in, which is the associated mileage factor. Now, that only comes in when a app-based worker travels at least 10 miles within an hour. And it's a little bit challenging to look at it outside of the context of like how far somebody would travel. But Councilmember Sarah Nelson did the math and calculated that a driver completing three deliveries of about 5 miles each within an hour would earn $34.34.
I will point out that we do know that a lot of trucks that move through the city are doing errands of less than 10 miles total. I mean, like literally half of the trucks in the city go less than 10 miles.
Well, you also have to think that when it comes to vehicle wear and tear, a lot of wear and tear occurs when you're doing shorter trips that involve starting and stopping and sitting at lights. So there could be a lot of discussion around what is fair compensation for this work. And certainly that's something that is, I believe, probably, you know, going to be in consideration for some time. But there was a real earnest attempt here to try to move the model from being what a lot of people at this point agree was an exploitative model in which employees were earning less than the minimum wage and they were using their personal vehicles to complete work, to one in which they are getting compensated more fairly.
The mindset for some of this is kind of interesting because when we think about salaries for workers outside of the gig economy, you start with an overall number and then you kind of pare it down how much you're actually going to take home. With this, it's building up from a absolute, like literally it's called minimum wage for a reason. And then we're adding on and debating whether or not that add on is enough to reflect what actually things cost.
That's true. That's a really interesting way to look at it. It is kind of like an opposite way to approach this, because normally you would be told that you're going to be paid a certain amount of compensation, and then you would look at your pay stub and see, oh, my employer contributed X amount toward workers' compensation, or I paid myself X amount into Social Security.
Now, well, this is moving legislation, so there are amendments going on. You started by saying this initially was supposed to cover both marketplace workers and on-demand workers. Again, what's the difference between those, and why isn't one of them hanging around?
Yeah, so the people who've been removed as of the most recent council committee meeting vote from the legislation are the marketplace workers. And marketplace workers are people who sell their service on an app-based marketplace. Some really good examples of these include Rover, which is a dog walking and pet sitting service, TaskRabbit, which is a app that allows you to hire people to do tasks for you. It's always seemed sort of nebulous to me, but I always associate it with building IKEA furniture.
I was just going to say IKEA furniture.
but it can involve, I guess, any sort of task that you need taken care of for you. And then, you know, another example is care.com, in which people will hire home health aides for people that are elderly or people who have disabilities. So there are many different kinds of workers that fall into this marketplace category. And, you know, it's challenging because on the one hand, people are setting their own rates in these services, which was by and large the argument that was used to explain why they should be removed from consideration in this legislation. And I will say that when you look at other cities that have been working on creating policies or that have created policies around regulating the marketplace for app-based workers, it's all been around the on-demand economy and not the marketplace economy. So Seattle taking that first step for that was really kind of revolutionary. But on the other hand, you know, yes, people are setting their own rates, but they're competing with other people on the app in what can often turn into a kind of a race to the bottom.
That seems to benefit the app itself, because the app is benefiting from people coming and economies of scale, while the individuals who are selling their services are in a race to the bottom.
Exactly. And it was brought up in discussion in the meeting when the amendment was discussed that the companies can advise people on how much they should charge for their services, but they don't create any kind of framework in which, you know, there are parameters for service costs that are put into place.
There's no floor.
Exactly. And, you know, for some of these services, it is hard to attach an hourly rate for them. Like, for instance, what hourly rate is fair to pay for somebody who is spending the night at your home with your cat?
Depends on how much you like your cat.
Exactly. I mean, there's a lot to think about with that. And also, I mean, people could say, well, the person is providing the service, but they're sleeping for the majority of the time, yet they're there, you know, in case some kind of emergency were to arise. So that's absolutely not the same as like paying someone on TaskRabbit to come to your house and, like, I don't know, reorganize your closet for you, right? Like, right. That's much more clearly an hourly task.
In looking at other industries where hourly rates are argued over and really broken down into minutiae, heck, medicine, where it's almost regulated down to the penny and the second by Medicare. Law, where it goes over and over again back to the professional responsibility folks. of, is this a legitimate charge to somebody?
The famous billable hour.
The famous billable hour. I mean, that was the cornerstone of the movie The Firm and overcharging and Tom Cruise getting all these people put away. But it's really, we've litigated this over and over and over again in hundreds of different places, and now we're doing it again for such stuff as esoteric as assembling an IKEA bookshelf.
And I do think that there should be a way to figure this out, right? So the argument in the beginning with a lot of these apps was, well, people aren't using them as their full-time jobs. They're using them as part-time jobs to make a little bit of extra money. And as a result, they might not mind getting paid less than minimum wage for their work. And I think in particular about Rover. And honestly, the people that I've known walked dogs on Rover have done it because they were college age and they wanted to make a little bit of extra money and they liked dogs. And it was seen as a way to get outside, get some exercise and have fun. But the thing is that's just representing one small subset of the people who are working in the industry. And even if people are, you know, in theory, willing to get paid less than minimum wage to do work, is it really fair then to put them up against somebody who's like, no, like, actually, I need to do the minimum wage to do this work, and I'm qualified to do this work. It really disrupts the employment marketplace.
So the new pay up legislation has the minimum wage and a transparency component. And by taking the marketplace folks out of the one part of it, the council has removed the marketplace folks from all the transparency part.
As it stands, yes. Now, this could change when it goes to a full council vote next Tuesday, mm-hmm. Which is coming up relatively fast. So we'll see. But yeah, and for that, I mean, the transparency, I think, is really important because, number one, it requires that the app-based worker knows what they're going to get paid and why ahead of time. And then number two, that the customer knows what the person who's completing the service is actually getting paid. This is something that, you know, myself as a consumer, I want to know. I want to know, you know, if I decide that, yeah, I want to pay somebody like $30 to walk my dog, well, that they're getting, you know, a sizable amount of that money and not a fraction of it.
It goes back to the discussion of these apps themselves are being supported through venture capital and giant flows of tech money moving through the system. And how much is the part they're skimming off the top of an individual's payment through the app really shoring up the app's own finances versus going to the person actually making the app a valuable resource?
And I'll give you an example about, you know, why this transparency is important, because when it comes to tips, people tend to, you know, assume if they're going to give a tip that it's going to the worker. Well, with these apps, that is not always the case. And so part of this legislation's intent was to make it codified that if someone decides to tip in addition to the cost, that money goes directly to the worker.
That's valuable in restaurants. That's valuable in every time that we are tipping.
The other thing I want to talk about briefly is the component that has been described as flexibility. And with that, what it means is that app-based workers cannot get penalized by the app for turning down offers. So right now, if you're an app-based worker, you live in fear, essentially, that you're either going to get downgraded on the app and given fewer offers, or you're going to be shut out of the app entirely. Now, this is mostly a concern for people who work on the on-demand side, where they can get penalized for not accepting deliveries that would entail driving a long distance, or just simply being unavailable to accept deliveries at certain hours. They are, you know, the algorithms that are in place assess them on their willingness to basically be available for work and do different kinds of jobs. Now, with the marketplace, of course, this is going to be a little bit different because people are selecting them to do a service. But in any case, it seems like, you know, it is imaginable that people could be impacted by either not turning down services, you know, turning down offers, or variety of different circumstances that could come up. And so you would think that these marketplace workers would also benefit from that kind of protection.
When we think of flexibility, the retort is always a cab driver not wanting to pick up a person of color or going into a certain neighborhood. But when you're talking about flexibility in on-demand stuff, you're also talking about a level of flexibility in this is an enormous burden on the things I'm bringing to this task, and I can't do it. And they are getting downgraded for those things. Why isn't that afforded to folks in the marketplace also?
Exactly. There was one other important change that came through by amendment to the legislation. And this was actually a request from Working Washington, which represents app-based workers. And that was to slightly decrease some of those associated cost, time, and mileage factors that I referenced earlier. I don't know a lot of the specifics around this. The council members who were on the committee all voted to do the decrease, and they were told that it was the preference of app-based workers that those costs go down. And, you know, as somebody who's just kind of speculating from the outside, I have to think that maybe people were getting concerned that the service would get so expensive that it would lead to a decrease in demand.
The intention of these bills is 100% supporting folks that are actually working. And then the folks who are actually doing a lot of these jobs are saying, no, please take it down a half a step because we're concerned that this is going to evaporate.
Yeah, that's where things get, I think, really complicated, because it's very easy from the outside to look and to say, wow, this is a job that it's just not meeting the requirements of what in our day and age we expect a job to be in terms of the compensation and the benefits that it can provide. But on the other hand, there are people for whom this is their livelihood, and maybe they can't imagine what else they would transition to doing. It's difficult because, you know, I could imagine a world in which Safeway or whatever grocery company hires people as full hourly employees to do deliveries. And in my perspective, that would be better than the current system that exists. But I'm not an insider. I don't know the full experience of what it's like to be one of these app-based workers. And maybe it wouldn't be better, or maybe they just don't dare, honestly, to be optimistic enough to think that the industry would move in that direction.
So what's the day next week when this is coming to a hearing?
So
Sorry.
Date. It's okay. Because it's a change in the month.
Oh my gosh, right?
So it's actually going to, no, it's going to be the 31st. Okay.
Okay.
So this will be coming for a full council vote next Tuesday, which is May 31st. And it's going to be very interesting to see how everything plays out. Because on the one hand, you have council members like Alex Peterson and Sarah Nelson, who have been on the committee in which this policy has been discussed and deliberated and crafted, who have been openly critical of it all along. And then on the other hand, you know, you have people like council members Liesl Herbold and Andrew Lewis, who were sponsors of the legislation and advocates for it.
And that's it for this week's podcast. We love to hear your thoughts. Send your comments, criticisms, and any ideas you have for good apps that respectfully treat their users to podcast@theurbanist.org.
Well, thank you for tuning in and learning more about this important issue.
That's it for this week's podcast. I'm Ray Debicki.
And I'm Natalie Argarius. We'll talk again soon.